Welcome to The Patriot, 1776. Hi, this is John Mady, and I am the pastor of Victory Baptist Church in North Fort Myers, Florida. And who is the Patriot of 1776? You are, and I am, and so is everyone who loves America and wants to follow the principles of our founding fathers. The last sentence of the Declaration of Independence reads like this: "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." If it had not been for the Patriots of 1776, we would still be paying taxes to England and drinking a spot of tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Help us win back America now, just like the Patriots of 1776 won America in the first place. You should take notes and use your Bible. We will give you our mailing address later. This week, we'll be doing something a little bit different than what we've been doing in the past. We're going to start looking at history. And the first thing that you want to do is to get this reference for the computer. And it's www.parliament.uk. P-A-R-L-I-A-M-E-N-T. And we're going to start by looking at the first thing that history tells us of the great possibility, and of course, we would have to say yes. This is the first real place where our founding fathers looked to get the kind of government that we have. To begin with, we have to go back to England, and a lot of our materials that we look at and a lot of the materials that we get come exactly from England, and yet England is the place that we broke from. And so we're going to begin looking at things to see how our government got started and look at particular dates. And the first real date that we can look at, if we can hang our hat on this first date, the date would be 1215, and that date is the Magna Carta. Now, we're going to be doing reading, and all of these things that I'm going to be reading right now will be from the computer website that I just gave you, www.parliament.uk. And so as we read, you need to listen and know that you can get these materials. As a matter of fact, I didn't get all the materials, but I wanted to give you enough material to give you an understanding of how we came to our founding fathers developing our country. First of all, Anglo-Saxon origins. The modern UK Parliament can trace its origins all the way back to two features of Anglo-Saxon government from the 8th to the 11th centuries. These are the Witan and the Moot. And first of all, the Witan was the occasion when the king would call together his leading advisors and nobles to discuss matters affecting the country. It existed only when the king chose and was made up of those individuals whom he particularly summoned. The Witan's main duty was to advise the king, but its assent was not necessarily for the king to take action, nor did it help frame the laws, as the modern parliament does, but primarily consented to the laws the king already decided to enact. However, Anglo-Saxon kings realized that they could not govern their territories without local support from these powerful men, and so began the delicate balancing act between the king's power and the power of those he governed. After the Norman conquest, kings of England began to govern through a smaller but permanent inner circle, inner council of advisors and officials. But occasionally the king would call on additional nobles, earls and barons, and churchmen, bishops and abbots, to gain their approval of his decisions, especially regarding taxation. This larger group of noble advisors, especially summoned, was known as the Great Council, Magnum Concilium, and it formed the basis for the modern upper house of Parliament, today the House of the Lords. And then that was the Wightons. And now, when we talk about the Moots, also under the Anglo-Saxon, there had been regular meetings or moots for each country or shire. I shouldn't say country. It says for each county or shire, where cases were heard and local matters discussed. The shire moot was attended by the local lords and bishops, the sheriff, and most importantly, four representatives of each village. After the conquest, this meeting became known as the county court, and it introduced the idea of representative government at the local level. These two gatherings remained separate for many centuries, but eventually the noble councillors of the Great Council and the local spokesman of the county court would combine to make a parliament of two houses, the aristocratic lords and the locally representative commons. So you can see this is the beginning of what we call in our country the House of Representatives and the Senate. And so those were how those two began. They didn't begin out of some particular way of saying, okay, now let's make a House of Lords and a House of Commons. It just happened that way. And over a period of time, they began going together and they made the Parliament. Now, the next thing that we want to talk about is how did the Magna Carta come about? Now, remember that the Wightons and the Moats came about around the 8th to 11th centuries. And the date for the Magna Carta was 1215. So how did the Magna Carta come about? Did they just decide, you know, this is a good idea, let's do it? Well, not exactly. Let's read a little further. King John became King of England, Duke of Normandy in France, the Duke of Aquitaine in France, the Court of Anjou in France, and Lord of Ireland in 1199. John inherited England and most of the western France, where he was more powerful than the King of France. In 1204, the King of France took Normandy and Anjou from John. John wanted to regain his lost territories in France, which his family had ruled for hundreds of years. John's attempts to recapture his family's lost territory in France meant that he needed money. Oh, surprise, surprise. He raised taxes in England much higher than they had been before, causing officials to become more and more oppressive in the way they collected these taxes. Raising taxes made John increasingly unpopular with the English barons, whom the king relied on to assist him in governing the kingdom. The immediate cause of the barons' rebellion was the decisive default in battle of King John's army in the Bovines in 1214, and that was by the force of the King of France. This, together with John's personality and ruthless actions, which seemed to have provoked hostility and fear in others more than the loyalty on which the kings of this period had to rely, caused much opposition among the barons. The defeat at Bovines led to the meeting at Runnymede, but opposition to the king had been brewing for longer. In 1212, there had been rumors of a plot to murder King John. Magna Carta was hammered out in negotiations between the leaders of the two armed parties, the king on the one side and the rebel barons on the other side. Neither side expected it to settle the matter, and both anticipated continued war between the king and the barons. Within 3 months of it being issued by Runnymede, Pope Innocent III had annulled the charter. The rebels had renounced their homage to the king and invited the son of the king of France to take the crown of England in John's place. So now the king, King John, had a great, great problem. And we're talking about the year 1214, 1212, 1213, 1214. And now in 1215 is when the Magna Carta comes about. And it says, Magna Carta is significant because it is a statement of law that applied to the king as well as to his subjects. Although the idea of England as a community with a law of the land independent of the will of the king was implicit in custom before 1215, Magna Carta gave this concept its first clear expression in writing. And everyone was dissatisfied with the government. So now along comes the Magna Carta. And the Magna Carta was an attempt by the rebels to state what they believed established custom to be, and by implication, where they believed the king was breaking the rules. The text reveals dissatisfaction not just with John, but with the whole system of government that had been developed by John's predecessors as well. The king, however, also pointed to customary rules to justify his position. Magna Carta was initially more than a piece of propaganda justifying the rebel cause than a piece of constitutional law. As a piece of baronial propaganda, it was distributed widely. Copies were sent to every county court in England, and it was ordered to be translated in the vernacular. It therefore very quickly became widely known and copied. Magna Carta's clauses provided the basis for important principles in England's law developed in the 14th through the 17th centuries. The phrases "to no one" and "no free man" gave these provisions a universal quality that is still applicable today, in a way that many of the clauses relating specifically to feudal system, a feudal custom, are not. The emphasis on grants of taxation requiring the consent of the kingdom also paved the way for the development of Parliament. What happened after Magna Carta was issued? Well, a few minutes after he had issued the charter, John persuaded the Pope to declare Magna Carta illegal because it interfered with the rights of the king. Now let me just stop right there for a minute and say this is why today in the United States that the liberals, Hillary, Bill Clinton, Obama, and all of those leadership people on the Democratic side, and the rhinos on the Republican side, they do not like the Constitution because the Constitution limits government. And Obama made the statement that if it weren't for the Constitution, he could get a lot more done. And that's exactly right. And that's why it says here, and I'm going to read that again and then just go on. A few months after he had issued the charter, John persuaded the Pope to declare Magna Carta illegal because it interfered with the rights of the king. The barons would not accept this, and a civil war broke out, in which most of the barons fought for Magna Carta against John. They withdrew their allegiance to John and invited Louis, the son of the king of France, to be king of England instead. Several of the leading rebel barons had connections in Scotland, and they encouraged King Alexander II of Scotland to take control of northern England. In October 1216, King John died. With most of England under the control of Louis and the rebels, including the King of Scotland, John's few remaining supporters, and the Pope's representative, Gwalla, decided to make his 9-year-old son, Henry, king. King Henry III was knighted and then crowned on the 28th of October, 1216. Following this, John's leading advisors sent out letters to all the rebels in the name of the new king, confirming Magna Carta and calling for their loyalty. Many of the barons left Louis of France and gave their loyalty to the young King Henry. Remember, he was 9 years old. For the remainder of Henry III's childhood, Magna Carta was repeatedly confirmed and reissued and became well known across England, not just among the barons, but also in the counties. Now, the contents of Magna Carta is also very interesting. Magna Carta is Latin for Great Charter, and the term was first used in 1217 to distinguish it from the Charter of the Forest, a document that also set out limits on the king's administration, this time of the royal forest, areas of the county set aside for royal hunting. Sounds like Robin Hood, doesn't it? And subject to the much harsher laws and restrictions. Both charters set out what the king could and could not do. In other words, Magna Carta set out the laws which the king and everyone else had to follow for the first time. Copies of Magna Carta were sent out to be read out in each county of England so that everyone knew of its existence. I'm going to pause there just for a minute. Isn't it interesting, as we go along here and we talk about England and we talk about the Magna Carta, notice how many things are similar and alike with what we have in America today. We have 50 states, and each one of our states has counties. In the state of Florida, we have 67 counties. And so it's interesting to see how there are similarities. And remember, from the 1800 to 1100 and 1200, these are all people who are figuring these things out for the first time. And we were able to look back on these things that they did, and we're able to use them in our country, and we have. All right, now let's look at Magna Carta again. There are 63 clauses in the Magna Carta. For the main part, the clauses do not deal with legal principles, but instead relate to the regulation of feudal customs and the operation of the justice system. There are causes of the granting of taxes, towns, and trades, the extent and regulation of the royal forest, debt, the church, and the restoration of peace. Only 4 of the 63 clauses in Magna Carta are still valid today. One part, number 13, 39, and 40, and of enduring importance to the people appealing to the charter over the last 800 years, are the famous clauses 39 and 40. No free man shall be seized, imprisoned, dispossessed, outlawed, exiled, or ruined in any way, nor in any way proceeded against, except by the lawful judgment of his peers and the law of the land. To no one will we sell, to no one will we deny or delay right or justice. These clauses remain law today, and provided the basis for important principles in English law developed in the 14th through the 17th century, and which were exported to America and other English-speaking countries. Their phrasing, to no one and no free man, gave these provisions a universal quality that is still applicable today, and in a way that many of the clauses relating specifically to feudal custom are not. So One of the things that you might have heard a couple of times now is the business about the feudal system. It's just simply talking about that the king has rule over everything, and what the king says goes. And so all countries were under that kind of a system until we came to the 8th century. And then in the 8th century, that's when things changed in England. And that's when the Whitons began. And that's when the Moots began. And so that's when the freedom began of the people. And so the Magna Carta in 1215 is very important. Now we take a look at, it's talking about the rise of the commons. And that's talking about one of the two houses in England. They have the House of Lords and the House of Commons. And so now we're looking at how the House of Commons got its real good start. Edward III came to the throne in 1327. And from that point, the representatives of the counties, Knights of the Shire, and of the towns, the burgesses, became a permanent part of Parliament. After 1332, they sat together in one chamber and were known as the House of Commons. After 1341, these commons deliberately separated from the king and his nobles. Edward III also stated his resolution that a parliament should be summoned annually. And between 1327 and 1485, there were only 42 years in which a parliament did not meet. With increasing regularity during the 14th century, the lords, and particularly the commons, acted on a sense that they should have an active say in government instead of merely consenting to the taxation decisions of the king. And then a speaker came along. Doesn't this sound familiar? We have the Speaker of the House. So by 1376, people were getting tired of the elderly Edward III's rule and the influence of his favorites. In the Parliament of that year, the Commons chose Sir Peter de la Marre to act as its spokesman before the king in joining its complaints with that of the Lords. De la Marre was thus the forerunner, office of Speaker of the House of Commons, a member selected by the Commons to chair its business and represent its views. The following year, Thomas Hungerford was the first spokesman to be termed Speaker in the official record. Then we have the Good Parliament. The Parliament of 1376 was called the Good Parliament. This was because the Commons prosecuted before the nobles some of the king's corrupt ministers, a process known as impeachment. Now, we have that word impeachment in our country, and at this particular time, we need to use that word a whole lot more. Okay, let's go on. This became a frequent procedure over the following years as Parliament turned against Edward III's successor, Richard II. And then there was what is called the Wonderful Parliament. In the Parliament of 1386, called the Wonderful Parliament, the Commons forced Richard II to dismiss his Lord Chancellor, whom it then impeached as well. And then another Parliament that had a name for it was Merciless Parliament. 2 years later, the Merciless Parliament condemned to death the former Lord Chancellor and other royal officials, and in October 1399, Parliament packed with supporters of Henry Bolingbroke, the future Henry IV, disposed Richard II by a trial and process in an assembly which met at Westminster. Now, we don't have enough time left to continue this, so I'm just going to mention a few things that will help us And I just want to help us to remember that this part of the lessons that we're talking about and the part of the things that we're talking about, you ought to write these things down. All that we've read today has come from www.parliament.uk. So www.parliament.uk. So you need to get into your computer and look that up, and you'll find a whole lot more information than what we've read. We'll continue reading the next time, and we've got some more things that we're going to talk about on the Parliament. And we've got just a couple of more pages. And it's going to be interesting to show, maybe you've already kind of picked it out, when it talked about bishops, Roman Catholicism. And this is what the bishops were all about. They were from the church, and it mentioned the church. And whenever in England, whenever it mentioned about those things, it's always talking about the Roman Catholic Church. And so we'll tie together some more of those things, and we're coming up close to the time to quit, but be looking forward, and I think you're going to be surprised the things that are going to be in these lessons, especially when we come to the King James Bible, which is one of the latest things. So comes the end of today's message. We appreciate so much that you spent time to be with us. If you enjoy our program, would you please take time to send us any questions you might have, along with a love offering of any amount? And if you send at least $25, we will send you a 92-page book, When Good Men Do Nothing, Who Will Speak? Our address is The Patriot, 1776, at 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Again, The Patriot, 1776. The address is 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Talk to you again next time. Goodbye now.